the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Most Americans and the medical profession are aware of the major killers of Americans. Diseases such as cancer affects 12 million Americans in the U.S., heart disease 25 million, and we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars. But there's another disease called autoimmune disease that affects 50 million Americans, and many may not be aware that they have an autoimmune disease. Joining me on the program is Dr. Sarah Ballantyne. She's the author of the best-selling New York Times book, The Paleo Approach, Reversing Autoimmune Disease and Heal Your Body. Sarah, let's begin a little bit with your own background. You're a doctor. Tell our listeners what led you to this approach, because you were dealing with many of the issues you talk about in your book, and it was through the paleo diet and approach that you resolved a lot of these issues. So tell us a little bit about your background as we begin.
Yeah, I'd love to, Jim. Thank you so much for having me on the show. So I have a PhD in medical biophysics, which is a big long word for saying I did medical research. And I did research in a lot of the parts of the body that are involved in autoimmune disease. I studied inflammation. I studied how the immune system works and how the immune system can break down and stop working. I studied gut health. I studied how cells that form the tissues that line our digestive tracts, how they actually interact with their environment, how they form tight bonds with their neighbors. And yet, I never actually performed any research with a nutrition lean to it. So it was always drug development. I mean, that's so much of what medical research is now. Let's understand some mechanism. Let's understand some pathway. Let's figure out what proteins are doing what. Let's manipulate the system, see if that helps whatever condition, and then we'll create a drug, right? And then we'll make our millions of dollars that way. And so while I was doing this research, I was really struggling with my own health. I was morbidly obese. I was close to 300 pounds. I had a dozen different diagnosed health conditions, so a lot of stuff that went along with the metabolic syndrome. So I had high blood pressure. I developed prediabetes, and of course, I was morbidly obese. But then I also had this collection of autoimmune diseases, and it really wasn't until I started addressing them with a paleo diet and starting to see improvements in my symptoms that I was also actually at the same time able to get a doctor who would properly diagnose me. So I had diagnoses from my sort of mid-20s in grad school, an autoimmune disease called lichen planus, which affects the skin, another autoimmune disease called psoriasis, which also affects the skin. I had been diagnosed with early rheumatoid arthritis. But it wasn't until really quite recently that I found out that I had Hashimoto's thyroiditis, an autoimmune disease that affects the thyroid, and explains symptoms that I struggled with back to age 7. And so part of my journey, you know, I was an academic and following a pretty high profile medical research career, and I was too sick. I was too sick to be able to be a woman in science and balance all the things that women in science do. You know, I had 2 children and I was trying to launch this great research career off the ground and I just couldn't keep up. And so I ended up having to make some really hard choices. And I ended up, I think, making some fairly unorthodox choices. So I decided to stay home when my first daughter was born and take a break from research and just focus on one thing at a time. So I just focused on motherhood. And what was great about making that choice was it gave me the space to really start thinking about my health. And I ended up losing 100 pounds following a low carbohydrate diet. But what was really interesting about that was the more weight I lost, the more symptoms I was suffering from most of my health conditions. So losing the weight resolved the prediabetes and the blood pressure, but my skin was getting worse. I was getting really bad joint aches, really bad migraine headaches. I was getting depression and anxiety symptoms. My skin was just a mess. You know, I had lichen planus and psoriasis. I would get eczema. I had really bad acne. I always had really dry skin. Like, it was just basically any way that your skin can not be healthy was pretty much what I was going through. And I had this moment when my second daughter was about 1.5, where I was just sitting in the chair in her room watching her play. And you know how sometimes you can be doing the most mundane things and the most insightful thoughts come to your head. And I said, oh, I guess being thin is different than being healthy. And I guess losing weight is not the same thing as getting healthy. I need to figure out how to be healthy. And so I was thinking about that and thinking about food sensitivities, because eczema was one of my skin conditions. And I'd heard that eczema can be caused by food sensitivities. So I started there in my search for a solution. And it was sort of the winding path of the internet that eventually brought me to the paleo diet. And when I first started reading about it, it sounded really extreme. And I think that's a really common experience for people who start like reading this list of foods you have to give up. And I had that same reaction. I was like, wow, I can't eat that. I can't eat that. I can't eat that. Even from a low carbohydrate diet perspective, it seemed still very restrictive. But I started digging in and getting into some of the science behind the paleo diet. And it really resonated with me on an sort of intellectual, you know, science geek kind of level. So I decided to try it. And within 2 weeks, I was able to go off all 6 prescription medications that I was on at the time, one of which I had been on for 12 years. And it was so impactful and such a huge change in how I felt, how I was sleeping, my energy levels, my migraines went away, my moods were better, my joints, the muscle aches started to ease, my skin started to clear up. It was such a huge difference for me. I was like, okay, there is really something here and I've got to understand it. And then not only do I have to understand it, I have to figure out how to share this. Because I've been struggling with these health conditions and all of these symptoms that are pretty invasive into, you know, quality of life. I've been struggling with this for, you know, at the time, 25, 30 years. I need to understand what is going on here. And so that brought me to really applying my science background to understanding nutrition, and then not just nutrition, but sort of the root causes of these diseases. And then not just that, but how stress and sleep and how in tune our lives are to what the sun is doing. So are we active during the day and sleeping at night, or are we shift workers? Understanding all of those details and how those impact our bodies at such a fundamental level to either promote health or undermine it, it really became sort of my obsession. Okay, let's be frank. I got obsessed about it. But that was what got me starting writing on this issue. So with both my website and then with my books, and really applying my scientific background and combing the medical literature in a way that there really aren't very many people doing. So when you're doing research on a specific topic, you are reading all of the background material within your field. But what's really interesting about this whole process of creating an optimal diet to have therapeutic potential for disease, right? That's a really specific thing, but it crosses many fields of science. So to be able to really go into how different compounds and foods are interacting the body at the cellular molecular level, so how are these things actually affecting our cells, actually affecting the proteins our cells make? Understanding that crosses so many different types of fields, you end up reading this very broad collection of scientific research. If I was going to a conference and I wanted to talk about this, there might be 10% of the people that I want to talk to at that conference. I'd have to go to 10 different conferences in order to talk to all of the different people who are doing research that help inform this thought process. And so it's kind of a really neat thing to do, because I get to actually sort of keep my foot in the door in terms of science, but also I get to read a way broader collection of scientific papers than I would get to do if I was still in academia. And I've really enjoyed this process of not just reading that science and understanding and forming a really great sort of big picture out of all of these thousands of different scientific studies, but then figuring out how to communicate that to the general public in a way that respects the public's intelligence. So without dumbing it down. I mean, that just that phrase bugs me, but the act of that phrase bugs me even more. And so for me, I really try very hard to explain the science with all of its details in a way that's still accessible, which is why the paleo approach is as thick as it is.
Let's begin. In your first chapter, you talk about the causes of autoimmune disease, and you get into the different immune systems we have. We have the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. Sarah, take our listeners through briefly some of the science behind it. What I found interesting about your book is I knew about the paleo approach. It worked. And, you know, I lost 20 pounds on it, and obviously I'm happy with the results, but I never really understood the science of all of it. And you get into the science, for example, leaky gut, what causes it, and how certain kind of foods that we eat really help to give us these problems that we have with our autoimmune system and these diseases that we're finding more and more about that are affecting more Americans than even cancer or heart disease.
Yeah. So it's amazing how we have this great, you know, sort of social awareness of cancer and heart disease and nearly no social awareness of this collection of diseases. There's about 140 different diseases that make up sort of the autoimmune disease umbrella. And there's almost no social awareness of this collection that affects double to quadruple the number of people. So where autoimmune diseases come from is a breakdown in the immune system. So the immune system is sort of, you can divide it in half in a couple of different ways. So you mentioned the innate and the adaptive immune system. The innate immune system is sort of the rapid responders, but they're designed to be really quick to protect the body against some kind of foreign invader, right? A virus, bacteria, a sliver, a piece of dirt, right? Something that's getting in the body that's not supposed to, whether it's ingested or an infection or, you know, something that's, you know, broken the skin, right? Like a sliver. So it's fast response, but at the expense of that fast response, we sort of lose specificity. So we lose the part where that part of the immune system doesn't really know what it's attacking. It has some sort of general ways to direct it to the location of where it needs to be, but it's not really good at differentiating between sliver and the skin cells around the sliver. The adaptive immune system is the part of the immune system that's specific and that's targeted, and it uses antibodies in order to direct an attack against a specific virus, a specific bacteria, a specific parasite. And so that part of the immune system is fundamental for what's called developing immunity. So it's how our bodies remember that we had that flu virus 3 years ago. And so when we get exposed to that exact same flu virus again, we don't get it. Now, some people go, wait a minute, I get the flu every year. What you're actually getting is a mutated virus. If you're getting the flu frequently, it's actually a slightly different virus every single time. So with viruses, our bodies remember, we saw that virus, we conquered it, and then we have these cells in our body who basically are just sentinel for when that virus comes back, so we can mount an even faster response and you don't actually get sick. And it's the adaptive immune system that's how vaccines work. So we put in what's called an antigen. So that's the thing you're going to make an antibody against. So maybe it's like dead flu virus or, you know, dead polio virus. And then we put in some kind of stimulator to sort of turn on the immune system so that we're forming antibodies against this dead virus in the vaccine and then making the cells that are going to remember it so that when we do get exposed to polio, our bodies fight it off before we ever get sick. So you can divide the immune system in that way, sort of the non-specific versus specific. But you can also divide the immune system by two other types of jobs. One job is attacking. So I see that virus, I'm going to attack it. And the other one is regulatory. So it's the part of the immune system that actually keeps the entire immune system restrained and stops it from going crazy and stops it from just like going in, continuing to attack. It's the part, there's a part of the immune system, the whole job it is to turn off the immune system when the job is done. And that regulatory arm of the immune system is phenomenally important when it comes to autoimmune disease because it's not working. So what happens in autoimmune disease is the immune system gets turned on. It accidentally somehow manages to trigger some kind of tissue within our body. And that's what's different between the 140 autoimmune diseases. It's just exactly which tissue or cell type is being attacked. And the part of the immune system that's supposed to turn that off and recognize that the immune system's not attacking the right thing, that part of the immune system fails. So it's like we have this fail-safe to make sure that the immune system can't attack our own bodies, and that fail-safe fails. And that's what's happening in autoimmune disease.
Let's talk about something that some of our listeners may have heard about, and that's called the leaky gut. How the various food or environmental factors that we're subject to, whether it's pollutants that we put in our body or that's in the environment, create the leaky gut, and why that is something you want to avoid if you have it and correct it, because this can lead to serious disease.
Yeah, so the gut is actually a barrier between the outside world and inside our bodies. So it's sort of a weird thing to think of, but the inside of the gut where your food is being digested is actually outside of our bodies. You can sort of think of it as like there's a continuous tube between our mouth and the other end. And what's inside that tube is not really inside our bodies. And so what's in there is food that's being digested, a bunch of great bacteria that are supposed to be helping with that digestion and generally doing a bunch of other great things for us. We like our gut bacteria. Toxins that are being eliminated from the body go into the gut. Those bacteria that are helping us out, well, they go through their normal life cycle. So there's dead bacteria. That's actually about 80% of the bulk of stool is made up of dead bacteria just going through their normal lives. Potential pathogens are in there. Potential environmental toxins are in there. excess hormones. So our body will try to get rid of excess hormones when we have that. That'll be in there. So there's a lot of different things in there. Our body's trying to regulate to not come in to our bodies. And so what happens is we've got this barrier, and it's only a sheet of a single cell wide that forms that barrier between inside the gut and inside our bodies. And it's a highly specialized type of cell because it's not the same as the skin barrier, right? The skin's another barrier between our bodies and the outside world. Skin barrier is a little bit different. It has to be really tough because we touch things and, you know, we move our arms and our legs. So it has to be sort of a different sort of tensile strength, but it also only keeps things out. The gut barrier is a little bit different because it actually has to let some things in. It has to let in the nutrients from the food that we're digesting. So it's what's called a semi-permeable barrier, but it's also highly specific. So its job is to let in nutrients, recognize those nutrients and let them in, and then keep all that other stuff that we don't want in the body out. So what happens is there's certain situations. So there's things like stress and things like infections and things like the wrong type of bacteria growing in our digestive tract that can impact how well that barrier is doing its job. But there's also compounds in our food, for example, gluten, which you already mentioned, that can also impact how well that barrier is doing its job. And what can happen is what is sort of colloquially referred to as leaky gut, more technically referred to as increased intestinal permeability. That's a great one to bring out at parties. But what happens is there's sort of two ways that you can basically create little tiny holes, very, very tiny holes, in that solid sheet of cells, that there's some pathway for things to leak into the body. One is you can negatively impact the health of those cells. So those cells are sick or those cells are dying. And so those cells then aren't doing their job, or if the cell's dead, but just left a hole where that cell used to be before another cell can grow into its place. But also these cells have really highly specialized connections of proteins that go from the inside of the cell to the outside of the cell and then wind around the proteins from the neighboring cell. And they create this kind of like glue that holds the cells together. But it's a really interesting glue because the cell can actually control whether or not there's like a little tiny channel for things to come in or whether or not nothing's coming in. So they have like this little ability to create a little window between each cell. And the cells use this for absorption of some types of nutrients. Some other types of nutrients actually get absorbed into the cell and then released on the other side of the cell into the body. So there's different ways that these cells can do their job, which is amazing. But what happens is there's certain, again, sort of compounds and foods that, you know, it's really not part of public discussion on healthy foods. But there's compounds and foods that can actually remove the cell's ability to control this glue between itself and its neighbor, and forces that glue to kind of start coming apart and creating a channel between the cells. And it's really pervasive how many different types of foods these compounds are in that can do that. So it's gluten, as we mentioned, but very similar proteins in other grains and very similar proteins in legumes like soy and peanuts. High amounts of sugar can do it. High amounts of sugar alcohol, Splenda, for example, and regular alcohol. And also stress can do that. Certain medications can do that. And so we have all of these, it's like our core digestive tracts are being constantly berated and attacked by the food we're trying to eat to nourish our bodies. And so the health of our gut is being affected. And so when you start to lose the ability to control what stays inside the gut and what comes across, that is when things can start leaking in. And why that's so bad, besides the idea of like toxins and bacteria and bacterial fragments, you know, re-entering the body. I mean, that sounds bad as it is. But what makes this so bad from a disease perspective is that the tissues around our digestive tract house about 80% of our immune system. And so when you think about the immune system getting stimulated, losing the ability to turn itself off, what leaky gut does is it's providing this constant stimulus to the immune system to be on, to be on, to be on, to be on. And if you combine that with something else that's going on in your body, like stress, like not getting enough sleep, like a genetic predisposition, like nutritional deficiencies, zinc deficiency, for example, that's really, really important for the regulatory arm of the immune system. That's where you get chronic disease. So you can get not just autoimmune disease. Basically, you know, inflammation is part of every chronic illness, and every disease in which a link to gut health has been investigated. So we're going to look and see if leaky gut happens in obesity. Well, it does. We're going to look and see if leaky gut happens in psoriasis. Well, it does. Every time they've looked to see if there's leaky gut in a certain disease, it's there. Is it there in all diseases? Well, we don't know that yet. But knowing what we know about how important that barrier is for how the immune system is doing its job. So if that barrier is working properly, then the immune system has more of an ability to regulate itself. And that's why it's just so phenomenally important to be protecting gut health. And you protect gut health by eating really nutrient-dense foods. So those are foods that have the biggest like nutrient bang for your buck. Things like organ meat, which people think are disgusting, but it's okay to hide it from yourself. It doesn't have to be liver and onions. There's lots of ways you can hide it and not know it the way you would hide it from your kids. You can hide it from grown-ups. Seafood and vegetables. And when you eat those foods, those are like the most powerful foods for protecting gut, but also for helping the immune system do its job, because the immune system is a huge nutrient hog. It uses nutrient resources like no other system in the body. And the part of the immune system that uses the most nutrients is the regulatory arm. So you need to provide all of the resources it needs. You know, it needs all of these vitamins and minerals to be able to do its job properly. If it doesn't have them, it can't do its job. So it's sort of this like, you get two birds with one stone, because you're eating for gut health. It just so happens that eating the exact same foods is good for immune health.
Sarah, I wonder if you just briefly talk about some of the things that you shouldn't eat. Things like grains, barley, corn, even things like oats, gluten, we know, like wheat, dairy, legumes. And then you have something, and maybe we ought to go to this. It's called the Paleo Approach Food Pyramid. And on it, on the left, for proteins, you have meat, which would surprise a lot of people because, you know, when we talk about heart disease, people tell you not to eat red meat. Fish, shellfish, poultry, and quality animal fats. On the other side, you have vegetables, fruit, expeller pressed oils, sea vegetables, and edible fungi. So let's talk about that, because these are really the healthy kind of foods. And for many Americans, if you were to tell somebody that has heart disease red meat, you know, that's almost the opposite of what they're being told.
Yeah, so what's really interesting is that there's these ideas that became sort of part of public health education from 20, 30, 40 years ago that have been really thoroughly debunked in the scientific literature. And really thoroughly, you know, saturated fats have been really thoroughly proven to be not the cause of heart disease. And so there's these ideas that public policy or public education on healthy food choices hasn't caught up. It's so far behind what science has showed that it's almost like three generations back. And so part of writing about these topics in the level of scientific detail that I do is about sort of updating everybody and sort of breaking some of these like really important sort of diet myths, you know, that saturated fat is bad for you, that red meat is bad for you. And, you know, it turns out that red meat is actually a very nutrient dense food, and it has a lot of vitamins in it that the immune system needs to be able to do its job. A lot of really great proteins for our bodies to be able to build not just muscle, but, you know, protein is part of every part of us, right? Every cell is made up of at least part protein. And so providing those raw materials is really, really essential. So the diet that I outline in the Paleo approach is called, by some people, called the autoimmune protocol. It's a more specific version of the standard paleo diet that is really designed to maximize healing for somebody who's going through chronic health problems. And so what happens with how you sort of determine which foods are going to be included and which foods aren't, you basically look at what's good in a food. You look at the vitamins, the minerals, the amino acids, what kind of fats are in that food. You look at whether or not there's good plant phytochemicals, fiber. These are all things that are really important for health. So you look at what's good in that food and what that food's going to contribute to your health. And then you look at what might be bad in that food, something that might irritate the lining of the gut, that might propel a leaky gut, something that might feed the wrong type of bacteria in your digestive tract, something that might spike your insulin or affect your hormones in other ways. And you look at those two types of things, the good stuff and the bad stuff, to oversimplify. And you kind of, you put it on a scale and you say, does this food have lots of good stuff and not very much bad stuff? Yes. All right. That's a great food to eat. Does this food have lots of bad stuff and not very much good stuff? Yes. Okay. That's the food that we're not going to eat anymore. And so what happens between paleo and the autoimmune protocol is we're a little bit stricter. So we're tolerating less of that bad stuff and we're really focusing on the most of that good stuff. So the food that is the most nutrient dense food, meat has phenomenally more easy to digest protein. Seafood is actually the easiest to digest protein. Meat is the second easiest to digest protein, and it's way easier for our bodies to access those proteins than plant proteins. And there's nutrients in animal foods that we cannot get from plants. But this is not an all meat diet. It is not a just eat lots of meat and poultry and fish. It's also like, wow, vegetables are phenomenally important. And actually, I sort of recommend as a starting place that about 3/4 of your dinner plate be vegetables and about 1/4 be a high quality meat or seafood. Vegetables provide tons of nutrients you can't get from animal foods. So you really need both. And vegetables are full of really important nutrients for the immune system, for protecting against free oxygen radicals and the damage that those can cause, which is an issue when your immune system is overactive. And it's also an issue with aging and things like that. It helps lower risk of cancer. Like, it's just plant phytochemicals are pretty amazing things. And so the foods that we avoid are the foods that have a high probability of causing a problem and don't offer a lot of nutrition. And that's a list that really surprises people, because whole grains are on that list. In fact, all grains are on that list. Grains are really not nutritious foods. And if you ask somebody, well, why do you need to eat grains? I mean, they'll usually say, oh, it's for the fiber, which is true. I mean, grains have fiber, but they have the same amount of fiber as vegetables or fruit. And vegetables or fruit typically have 1/4 to 1/2 the amount of sugar and typically 10 times the amount of vitamins and minerals and important phytochemicals. So you always win by replacing grains in your diet with fruits and vegetables, which is, I think, a sort of a natural swap for people. You also cut out dairy products. Within the paleo community, there's this discussion about high-quality dairy, grass-fed, raw dairy versus the stuff that you get at the average grocery store. They are basically completely different foods. But for someone dealing with chronic health conditions, even in that super high-quality dairy, there's some compounds that are potentially problematic. We cut out alcohol, which is very sad, and I apologize to everybody. Nuts and seeds, eggs, and the one vegetable that gets cut out is a family vegetable called nightshades, which includes tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, and potatoes. And that's because they're actually quite inflammatory. There's several compounds in tomatoes, for example, 3 different compounds in tomatoes that have been investigated for use in vaccines. I mentioned that in a vaccine is something to, you know, trigger the immune system to develop antibodies against whatever dead flu virus, whatever's in it. Well, they've actually done research on these compounds in tomatoes to show that they'd be really good to add to vaccines to stimulate the immune system. But what's left? Okay, let's talk about what's left. Meat, seafood, you know, high quality animal fat, right? Poultry, shellfish, vegetables of, like, there's still several thousand different kinds of vegetables that are left after you take out nightshades. Fruit, high quality vegetable oils like expeller pressed, so something like olive oil or avocado oil or coconut oil. Sea vegetables and mushrooms, right? Edible fungi, mushrooms and other similar lion's mane. And there's some other similar fungi that I guess are not technically mushrooms. There's a huge amount of variety within that. It takes a little bit of commitment and dedication to get through that adjustment of, okay, well, I used to cook this every Tuesday night. Now what am I going to do? But there's still a ton of different foods and they're all the most nutrient dense foods. But what happens is there's some foods that, you know, people tolerate different things. So it would be completely ridiculous to say this is a one-size-fits-all approach and that everybody who has autoimmune disease can't eat eggs for the rest of their lives, or everyone that has autoimmune disease is not going to be able to eat walnuts. And so there is also a really important recognition of individual variability and the fact that there's a lot of different things that go into how our body tolerates an individual food. So part of it is, you know, the nutrients, and part of it is the other compounds that might be undermining our health. But part of it is genetics, right? Genetics will partly determine how we respond to, you know, where we cut that off. Stress determines how well we respond to certain foods, how much sleep we're getting, how active we are, what our mental health is like. All of those things are affecting how our bodies physically respond to the foods that we're eating. And so I recommend cutting out these potentially problematic foods and really focusing on high quality meat, including organ meat, lots of seafood, lots of vegetables, some fruit, and focusing on that until you're starting to feel better, and then experimenting, because a lot of people can tolerate some of these foods that are eliminated. There's also the possibility that some of the foods that are recommended might not work for people that might have food intolerances against them, for example. And so it's a template, right? It provides a framework based on our best understanding of the current science in terms of what are the best food choices. And so that also implies that as more science is performed, you know, these recommendations have to be flexible, because as we have a more detailed understanding of how different compounds and foods are affecting our bodies, these recommendations could change. I think that there's definitely a really solid scientific case for every single recommendation right now. But there are some foods, you know, that are maybe a little bit harder to sort of say a definitive yes versus a definitive no. Coffee is a great example. There is a collection of studies showing health benefits to moderate regular coffee consumption. And then there's a collection of studies showing health detriments to moderate regular coffee consumption. So what do you do? Okay, so I've got all these great things that coffee might do, and then I've got all these bad things that coffee might do. Should I drink coffee? And it's really hard to answer that question. And so what we do with, you know, severe chronic illness and autoimmune disease, we say, well, look, like, we're not in a place where we can gamble. We're not in a place where we can say, well, I'm just going to do it and hope that I fall under this group of people that are seeing some benefit, or that that group of studies is actually providing the truth about coffee, and I'm just going to ignore all these things that tell me coffee is bad. What we do is go, okay, look, coffee might be bad. It might be stopping us from healing. It might be slowing down our healing. It might be undermining our health. Let's cut it out. Let's cut out anything else that we think might be a problem. And then once we're starting to feel good, let's add it back in and see how we feel when we're drinking coffee, and be really critical. It's really easy to get over-focused on, I want this food to work for me because I love this food, and kind of ignore how it's actually making us feel. We have to sort of keep that in mind. But we get to experiment, and we get to really find, you know, this starting place that helps us heal as quickly as possible. Then we get to find what really is the optimal diet for us as individuals. And that's what this is all about, right? How do we become healthy, and how do we adopt a diet, but also a lifestyle that we can maintain for the rest of our lives, and that is going to support our best health for the rest of our lives?
Sarah, just briefly, one of the things I found really surprising, I spent a lot of time exercising, but there's also detrimental effects of too much exercise. Can you address that briefly as we close?
Yeah, so activity is phenomenally important for our health. Movement, especially gentle movement throughout the day, weight-bearing movement like walking, phenomenally important for our health. And some kind of activity that's building muscle, and we know there's tremendous health benefits from that. But there is a window of moderation where exercise is really beneficial. Too little, right? A sedentary lifestyle, we know that causes, you know, health problems. We know that it increases risk of disease, risk of mortality. And that's a really easy thing for people to wrap their heads around. Well, if I sit all the time, that's obviously not good for me. But there's also this other side of the happy medium of too much exercise, especially high intensity, exhaustive exercise. So for example, training for a marathon would fall under that category. That also undermines their health. And we actually see it in elite athletes. They have higher risks of certain diseases that are associated with a dysfunctional immune system. So higher risks of certain autoimmune diseases, things like asthma, more susceptibility to infection. And there's actually an entire collection of studies that are looking at how that sort of high strain exercise, most of the studies are done in runners and cyclists and triathletes, and how that affects gut health. So it turns out when you are exercising at that intensity level, your body actually deflects blood from your digestive tract. Digestion is not a priority if you're running away from a lion, basically, which is what your body thinks you're doing. So your body takes the blood away from your digestive tract and puts it into your muscles, puts it into your brain for decision making. So there's this priority of, I'm going to run away from this lion, and I'm going to know whether or not it's good to climb this tree or jump over this cliff, right? I got to be able to make that decision snap. So I'm going to have more blood flow to my brain and more blood flow to my muscles. What happens when that's a prolonged period of time, but our bodies are sort of really good at these short, stressful situations. And what marathon training is, or these really long cycling training sessions that the cyclist might do, this is a prolonged stress on the body. And what happens when our blood flow is diverted away from the digestive tract is that actually causes a leaky gut. And there's a bunch of studies that actually show that, for example, taking NSAIDs like Motrin or Advil during running, which is actually a really common practice. I used to run marathons in my 20s. It's a really common practice among marathon runners, at least the ones that I knew. You know, you've got a lot of muscle pain, you're going to take these sort of Advil prophylactically before your training run. That actually worsens the leaky gut that's caused by those types of exercises. Exercising in the heat, so if you're running outside and it's over, I think the cutoff is something like 27 or 28 degrees Celsius. So if it's in the 80s Fahrenheit, then that's going to increase the impact on your digestive tract, whereas if you're exercising in the cold, it's going to minimize the impact on your digestive tract. But there's this very large collection of studies showing that this high intensity exercise as a stress on the body and causes a leaky gut. So if you're a person who's trying to heal a leaky gut, you're making all these food choices, and maybe you're taking supplements, you know, going to bed at 8:30 in the evening to get enough sleep so that your body can heal, you're continuing to do these really high strain exhaustive exercises is sort of undermining the other choices that you're making. And so it becomes a, well, how do you know? And that's a really tough question to answer, because what is too much exercise depends on how physically active you have been historically, what type of activity you're doing, how long you're doing it for, what's your percent effort, what was your heart rate at the time, when you last ate, how well hydrated you are. These are all inputs into whether or not that activity that you did that day is going to make your gut leaky, and then how long it's going to take before it resolves. And exercise is really important. So I don't like to scare people away from doing exercise, but I like to encourage people to think really critically about the type of exercise they're doing and whether or not that's something that's really helping them get healthy. And then what is their metric of healthy? It should be, if they're suffering from a disease, the symptoms of the disease should be one of those metrics. I have encountered more than one person who exercises at a very high intensity level because they like what that does for their body composition, but they ignore how that affects their health conditions. And so that becomes practice and mindfulness and intent and really understanding how that choice is really affecting our bodies and knowing that too much is going to undermine our health and that there's this happy medium that needs to be sought after.
Sarah, would you recommend anytime somebody has been sedentary or changes something, sometimes it's advised that you see a doctor. If you were to go on the paleo approach, you start changing your diet, eliminating foods, and doing many of the things you talk about in your book, from moderate exercise, de-stressing, a lot of these things, should that be coordinated with the doctor before embarking on a program? And especially if you are in a situation where you have one of the many numerous autoimmune diseases or the signs of one.
Always, 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 always. I mean, whenever you're doing any kind of dietary change, fitness program, changing supplements, and especially if you're on medications, the doctor's supervision is really important. And for ways that might surprise you, the recommendation is always you need a doctor's supervision in case you do something bad and make yourself worse. In this case, you know, when you're taking medication, for example, if you have the autoimmune disease that I have, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you may be taking thyroid hormone replacement because that's typically required when your thyroid's not working anymore. But as you start to make these changes, your thyroid function may increase, which means that when you add your dose of thyroid hormone on top of that, you may end up being hyperthyroid, which has a whole pile of health risks associated with it. So you're part making sure that a doctor is monitoring you for worsening of your health conditions, other things that you might want to worry about, but you're also working with your doctor to reevaluate where you're at to make sure that your medications don't need to be tweaked. You know, a lot of people might be on disease-modifying drugs or steroids that they want to try to go off. That absolutely has to 100% of the time be done with medical supervision, because changing those types of medications is not something that is straightforward to do. It has really profound impacts on the body. It needs to be done very slowly. There's a weaning off process. And there's this desire, especially when we're faced with, oh my gosh, look at how powerful food can be. Look at how powerful just getting enough sleep can be for our health. I want to now go off all of my drugs. And that's a nice goal, but it's not necessarily practical in every situation. And it's not something that can necessarily be done really quickly in every situation. That really needs to be done with medical supervision. I really feel like there is a sort of best of both worlds place in between, where we're eating in a very nutrient-focused way and we're making lifestyle choices that are very health-focused, getting enough sleep, managing our stress, being active, but not too active. And we're taking the best that medicine has to offer us and finding this amazing place of health in between, you know, those two, what are often thought of as sort of being opposing views, whereas really they can be very complementary.
Well, Sarah, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. And once again, for those listening to this program, the name of the book is called The Paleo Approach, Reverse Autoimmune Disease and Heal Your Body by Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, who's been my guest. Sarah, all the best to you, and thank you so much for coming on the program. You know, I've read a number of books on the paleo approach, and I now consider yours to be the Bible. The thing that I really liked about your book, and especially in the first couple chapters, I'd heard terms like leaky gut, and I've heard about you know, the disease problems that are caused through basically our gut system. What I got from your book was the medical reasons why things happen the way they do. So you get better understanding of why, when you eat certain foods, the damage it does medically, and then how good foods can help heal this. The good news, I think, for all our listeners is no matter what condition you are, you can improve it. So once again, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you.
You know, I've interviewed a number of authors on diets, everything from vegetarian diets to the paleo approach. And, you know, my own preference has been the paleo approach. That's the thing that I found has worked the most for me and probably something easier to find. I don't know about you. Have you ever tried a diet before, you know, measuring your calories, counting your food, measuring your food size, you know, five meals a day, all these kind of things that make it so complicated. I found those things did not work. And when you adopt a healthy diet, something that works for you, and everybody's a little bit different, the paleo approach was something I found worked for me. But along the paleo approach, I would consider Sarah's book to be the Bible today. It has more information than you can believe. It's not just, you know, these are the bad foods, these are the good foods, but also explains medically what happens to us when we have a poor diet and how we can heal ourselves and the impact of good, nutritious foods. You read this book, you will think totally different about when you go to the grocery store. I know I think very differently today when I do the grocery shopping, and even also more aware of what to look for on labels. I don't care if it's everything from a super green drink to also the kind of meats I buy now. I buy grass-fed beef and things that don't have the chemicals and pesticides that are so harmful to us. But once again, I highly recommend this. I think you'll find it enjoyable. A little bit more on the scientific side, but once you want to understand what makes you healthy and what doesn't. Well, once again, that ends today's interview. I hope you enjoyed it, and happy health to all of you. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk. We'll be right back.